steps. That's why I was waiting for you here instead of at Kira's house. Okay, I said. Go ahead. Lohengrin took a few hesitant steps toward the other end of the basement before halting and turning back to me. Listen, Mr. Watts, she said, keeping her eyes on the floor. I don't mean any disrespect, but would you mind verbally confirming that the reward is still $1 billion? Not at all, I said. If anything you tell me helps me locate one of the 7 shards of the Siren's soul, then I will immediately transfer $1 billion to your Oasis account. It's all outlined in the contract you signed when you sent me your clue. Before anyone could try to claim the reward, they were required to sign a digital shard clue submission contract that my lawyers had drafted. I located the copy Lohengrin had signed and displayed it in a window in front of her. The print was too fine to read without squinting, and the text scrolled on for several pages. This contract states, among other things, that if the information you present to me proves to be valid, you agree not to share it with anyone else for a period of 3 years. You also agree not to discuss the details of our transaction with anyone, including the media. If you do, you forfeit the reward and I can take it all back. Oh, I've read the contract, she said, grinning but still not meeting my gaze. A few thousand times. Sorry, I didn't mean to insult you. It's just, that's a lot of zenny for me. I laughed. Don't worry, Lo. If you can help me find one of the 7 shards, then that money is all yours, I promise. She nodded and took a deep breath. The look of nervous anticipation on her face set my own heart racing. If this kid was lying about finding one of the shards, then she deserved an Academy Award for her performance. Lohengrin turned and walked over to the bookshelves that lined the basement's far wall. They were filled with sci-fi and fantasy paperbacks, role-playing game supplements, and back issues of various vintage gaming magazines like Dragon and Space Gamer. Lo began to flip through the huge collection of old Dungeons & Dragons modules shelved there, apparently looking for one in particular. I'd browsed through that very same bookshelf 7 years ago during the early days of Halliday's contest, and I'd read or skimmed over most of those old modules and magazines, but not all of them. The remaining titles were still on my reading list when I won the contest, at which point I'd forgotten all about them. Now I was kicking myself, wondering what I'd missed. For the past few years, I've been scouring Middletown looking for a way to alter the time period of the simulation, Lo said. You know, because of the couplet. The couplet? She paused in her search and turned around to look at me. On Kira's headstone? Oh, right, I said, of course. I had no idea what she was talking about, and Lohengrin could obviously see it on my face. Her eyes widened in surprise. Oh my God, you don't even know about the couplet, do you? No, I replied, throwing up my hands. I guess I don't. She frowned at me and shook her head, as if to say, how far the mighty have fallen. You know how in Peter Jackson's film adaptation of The Two Towers, there's a scene where King Theoden places a seam Baalmune on Theodred's tomb, she asked. I nodded. Well, if you visit the recreation of Kira's grave on E-Earth, and place a seam Baalmune taken from Arda on it, a rhymed couplet appears on her headstone, Lo said. Other types of flowers indigenous to Middle-earth might work too. I'm not sure. I didn't try any of them. I felt like a complete idiot. I'd visited Kira's grave on E-Earth several times to search for clues, but I'd never thought to try this. At least I could try to hide my embarrassment since I wasn't rolling real. Lohengrin opened a browser window in front of her avatar, then spun it around so I could see it. It showed a screenshot of Kira's headstone on E-Earth. Below her name and the dates of her birth and death was an inscription, Beloved Wife, Daughter, and Friend. Below that were 2 additional lines of text, which did not appear on her headstone in the real world. The first shard lies in the Siren's first den, so the question isn't where. But when? There it was. After all these years, a genuine clue. And it seemed likely that Lohengrin was the first and only person to discover it, because no one else had submitted it to me in an attempt to claim the reward. When I found that couplet, Lo continued, I thought the Siren's first den might be the place where Kira was living when she created Lucosia, her old guest bedroom here on Middletown. But the time period of this simulation is always set to 1986. Kira only lived in Middletown during her junior year of high school, from the fall of 1988 to the summer of 1989. So to reach the Siren's Den, I figured I would need to alter the time period of the Middletown simulation to a different when. I tried everything I could think of, including time travel. She held up an object that resembled an oversized pocket watch, a rare time travel device called an Omni. But no dice. Time machines don't function here the way they do on some other planets like Zemeckis. This was something I already knew firsthand. I'd brought my own time machine, Ecto 88, to Middletown to try the same thing. I'd upgraded the car with a fully functional and extremely expensive flux capacitor, which allowed me to time travel on planets where doing so was an option. For example, on E-Earth, I could travel as far back as 2012 when the Oasis was first launched and GSS began backing up previous versions of the simulated Earth on their servers. But my flux capacitor wouldn't function on Middletown, so I dismissed time travel as a possibility. But I knew from the riddle that changing the time frame had to be part of the solution, Lowe continued. So I kept on searching for another way. She turned around and continued to flip through the D&D modules on the bookshelf. Then, earlier this week, I was browsing through Og's old gaming library here when I came across something strange. She finally located the item she was looking for and carried it back over to me. It was a shrink-wrapped wall calendar for the year 1989, featuring the work of a fantasy artist named Boris Vallejo. The painting on the cover depicted a pair of Valkyries riding into battle. My eyes widened, then darted to the calendar already hanging on the basement wall. It, too, was a Boris Vallejo artwork calendar for the year 1986. The month of October was currently displayed. It featured a painting of a bikini-clad female warrior astride a black steed, brandishing a magic ring at an incoming flight of dragons. Out of curiosity, I'd looked up the name of this painting once. It was called Magic Ring, and it had also been used as the cover artwork for a 1985 fantasy novel called Warrior Witch of Hell. Like the other wall decorations in Og's basement, the calendar couldn't be taken down or removed, and its pages couldn't be flipped to another month. Halliday coded the Middletown simulation to recreate his hometown circa October 1986, right? Lowe said. So why would there be a calendar for the year 1989 here? Good question, I said, glancing between the calendar on the wall and the one in her hand. But Gunters around the world spent years studying the contents of this room. Why didn't any of them find it? Because it wasn't here, Lowe said, grinning wide. I checked Gunterpedia. There's an itemized list of every single object in this basement. The only calendar listed on it is the one hanging on the wall. She held up the 1989 calendar. So either they somehow missed this one, or it appeared on that bookshelf after Halliday's contest ended, I finished. Lohengrin nodded and held the 1989 calendar out to me. Now, try swapping it with the one on the wall. I took the calendar from Lohengrin. Then, with my other hand, I reached out and tried to take the 1986 calendar down off the wall. To my surprise, it slid right off the nail it was hanging on. I carefully hung up the 1989 calendar in its place and opened it to the month of January. As soon as I let go of the calendar, its pages began to flip upward on their own until the month of April was displayed. As the pages were flipping, the sky outside cycled rapidly between day and night, pulsing on and off like a strobe light. The entire Middletown simulation was fast-forwarding all around us like time-lapse film footage played back at high speed. When the strobing stopped, our surroundings had changed. The couches in Og's basement had rearranged themselves, and two more bookshelves had appeared against the far wall, both filled with more gaming supplements. There were also several new posters on the walls, but the most striking difference was the time of day. Outside the basement windows, night had fallen. The streetlights were on, and there was a full moon out. Whoa, I heard myself whisper. I glanced at the digital alarm clock sitting on top of one of the bookshelves. Its glowing blue display said the local time was now 1:07 a.m. I turned back to Lohengrin. She was beaming with pride. Swapping the calendars changes the time period of the Middletown simulation from October 1986 to April 1989, she explained. But only this one instance of the simulation has been updated. The other 255 copies of Middletown spread out across the planet remain set to the 1986 version. I've checked. If this is April in 1989, I said, then what happens if we go over to the Barnett's empty guest bedroom now? Lowe grinned. Before we head over there, you'll need to obtain an item located in this room. An audio cassette tape that Kira gifted to both Halliday and Ogg. She locked eyes with me, studying my reaction. What, are you actually quizzing me now? I asked. Lowe nodded and folded her arms. The dubious expression on her face made me laugh out loud. It was called Lucosia's Mix, I said. Oscar Miller mentions it in his memoir, The Middletown Adventurers Guild, but he doesn't give the full track list. He just mentions one song that was on it. There Is a Light That Never Goes Out by the Smiths. Lowe nodded. That's exactly right, she said. And now that we've jumped ahead to 1989, there are two copies of Lucosia's Mix in the Middletown simulation. One in Halliday's Walkman in his bedroom, and one here. She walked over to the ground-level window at the opposite end of the basement, which looked out onto the Morrow's moonlit backyard. Ogg's boombox was resting on the window ledge. She pressed the eject button and removed the tape inside. According to Miller's book, Kira made two copies of this mixtape, she said, holding it up. She gave one to Ogg and one to Halliday a few months before her school year abroad ended and she had to go back home to London. She tossed the tape to me and I held it up to read the sticker on its A side. Lucosia's Mix was written on it in cursive above a track list insert filled out in the same handwriting. Thanks, I said, adding the tape to my inventory. Lowe was already running up the basement steps. Kira's house is just a few blocks from here, she shouted over her shoulder. Follow me! When we reached the Barnett's house a few minutes later, Lohengrin halted at the end of the darkened sidewalk leading up to it. Then she pointed up to Kira's bedroom window on the second floor. It was the only room in the house with a light on. In fact, glancing up and down the street, I saw that it was the only illuminated window on the entire block. Lohengrin saw me noticing this and nodded her approval, but she didn't say anything. I thought for a moment, then took the copy of Lucosia's Mix out of my inventory and examined the track list. There it was, the seventh song on side A. There Is a Light That Never Goes Out by the Smiths, one of Kira's all-time favorites. I turned to point this out to Lohengrin, but she was already sprinting into the house. I followed her inside. Lohengrin was waiting for me inside the guest bedroom. On my previous visits, this room had been undecorated and empty, aside from a bed, a dresser, and a small wooden desk. Now, sci-fi and fantasy paperbacks were piled everywhere, and posters adorned the walls. The Dark Crystal, The Last Unicorn, Purple Rain, The Smiths. Homemade collages hung there, too, made from magazine clippings of video game characters and artwork. Sheets of graph paper were tacked up everywhere, filled with Kira's meticulous renderings of characters, objects, and landscapes from classic role-playing video games like Bard's Tale and Might and Magic. I'd read about this. Kira had spent hundreds of hours copying pixels from the screen onto the graph paper, coloring them in by hand one square at a time to figure out how different artists achieved their effects and improve on their techniques. When she worked at GSS later on, she became famous for creating artwork that pushed the boundaries of the computer hardware available at the time. Ogg was fond of saying that his wife had always had a knack for bringing pixels to life. I turned around slowly, trying to absorb as many details as I could. There were no family photos displayed anywhere, but she did have several pictures taped around the edge of her mirror, showing Kira with her nerdy new circle of friends. Halliday, Ogg, and the other misfit members of the Middletown Adventurers Guild. Several of those boys would later write tell-all books about growing up with Halliday and Ogg, and like every other diehard Gunter, I'd scoured them all for details that might help me unlock the puzzles and riddles Halliday left behind. I reread them all again a few years ago, this time absorbing the details they contained about Kira's life, so I knew that not a single one of them described the interior of her room at the Barnett residence. She was never allowed to have male visitors up there, and none of the boys in the guild had ever seen Kira's room, including Ogg and Halliday. But I would have been willing to bet they'd both spent plenty of time imagining what it looked like. Maybe that was what I was looking at now, a simulation of what Halliday imagined Kira's room looked like back then. A small color television sat on Kira's desk with a Dragon 64 home computer connected to it. Seeing this made me smile. The Dragon 64 was a British PC built with the same hardware as the TRS-80 Color Computer 2, the first computer Halliday ever owned. According to one of the old journal entries he included in Anorak's Almanac, when he found out that he and Kira owned compatible computers, Halliday took it as a sign they were meant to be together. He was wrong, of course. Kira had a color dot matrix printer hooked up to her computer, and the giant cork bulletin board on the wall above her desk was filled with printouts of her early ASCII and ANSI artwork. Lots of pixelated dragons and unicorns and elves and hobbits and castles. I'd seen them all reprinted in collections of Kira's artwork, but looking at them again now, I was still amazed at the detail and nuance she had been able to create with so few pixels and such a limited color palette. Lohengrin walked across the room, over to Kira's dresser, which had a small Iowa stereo system sitting on top of it. She pressed the eject button on its cassette deck, then pointed at the empty tray. "Go ahead," she said. "You can do the honors." I walked over, put Lucosia's mix into the tape player, and fast-forwarded until I reached the end of the sixth song on the first side, "Jesse's Girl" by Rick Springfield. When I hit the play button, I heard a few seconds of analog tape hiss before the next song began, and Morrissey began to croon, "Take Me Out Tonight." I glanced around the room. Nothing happened. I glanced over at Lohengrin. She held up a hand and mouthed the word, "Wait." So we waited. We waited until about 3 minutes into the song when Morrissey starts to sing a riff on the title over and over again. "There is a light and it never goes out." As he sang "light" for the first time, the lid of a wooden jewelry box sitting next to the stereo flew open and a necklace floated up out of it as if lifted by an invisible hand. It was silver with a blue gemstone, and I recognized it as the one Kira was wearing in her 1989 Middletown High School yearbook photo. According to his autobiography, Og gave it to her the first time he told her he was in love with her. When the Smiths' song ended, there was a blinding flash of light. When it faded, the floating necklace had transformed into a large, blue, teardrop-shaped crystal spinning in front of us at eye level. There it was, at long last. One of the seven shards of the Siren's soul. 0007. I stared at the shard in awe, feeling a strange combination of exhilaration and disappointment. I'd finally uncovered the first shard's hiding place. But after 3 years of trying, I hadn't been able to do it on my own. No, I'd had to be led here like a noob following a walkthrough, buying victory like some clueless sixer instead of earning it on my own or with the help of my friends. But my shame couldn't drown out the rush of relief and validation. The shards were real. I still wasn't sure what I was hunting for or why it mattered, but now I knew this wasn't just some meaningless riddle. It really was another hunt created by Halliday, and whatever the prize was, it had to be important. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a blur of motion as Lohengrin reached for the spinning shard. Her hand passed right through it as if it were a hologram. "I've tried picking it up dozens of times, dozens of different ways," she said. "No matter what I try, my hand passes right through it. I don't think anyone can touch it except you, Halliday's heir. To get the shard, you have to pay some sort of toll, whatever that means. For each fragment, my heir must pay a toll to once again make the siren whole." "There's only one way to find out," I said, reaching out for the shard. My fingers didn't pass through it. They closed around it. And as they did, for a moment I was somewhere else. I was in a school classroom filled with old BBC microcomputers. There was no one else in the room. I was sitting at one of the computers and I could see my reflection in its monitor. Except it wasn't mine. It was Kira Underwood's face staring back at me. She, or rather, I, looked about 9 or 10 years old, and I felt exhilarated. My skin and scalp were tingling, and I could feel my pulse racing and my heart thudding inside of my tiny chest. I was staring at the screen, admiring a piece of artwork I'd just finished creating. A pixelated unicorn, rearing up on its hind legs, silhouetted against a crescent moon. I recognized this image. It was famous. It was the very first piece of digital artwork Kira Underwood ever created. And I appeared to be reliving the moment just after she had created it. And then I was back, in my own body, standing in Kira's bedroom, the guest room in Middletown. Somehow, I'd just spent a moment inside Kira's past. I was still reeling when a series of cascading chimes rang in my ears and a message appeared on my HUD. Congratulations, Parzival! You've found the first of the 7 shards of the Siren's soul. What happened? Lohengrin said. You zoned out for a second. Are you all right? I looked down at the luminous blue shard in my hand. I had some sort of vision, I said. Like a momentary flashback? I guess that was the toll I had to pay. A flashback? She repeated slowly. What do you mean? It felt like an ONI recording, I said, but it only lasted for a few seconds. I was Kira Underwood, or at least it felt like I was her. And I was reliving the moment when she created that unicorn on a computer at her school when she was 10. The crescent moon unicorn? Lo said, eyes wide with awe. But it had to be a simulation, right? ONI headsets didn't exist back in the 80s, and Kira died years before they were even invented. I nodded. I'd just been thinking the same thing. No, it obviously couldn't have been a real ONI recording, I said, but it felt like one. Halliday must have simulated it, though I don't have the first clue how he could have done it so convincingly. Or why, Lo said, shaking her head. Why would he create a sim of one of Kira's childhood memories? From her perspective, that would be a pretty messed up night of programming, man, even for Halliday. I was considering this question when an urgent notification flashed on my HUD. It was an icon I hadn't seen in years. A scoreboard alert. When I selected it, a web browser window appeared in front of my avatar, displaying Halliday's old website where the scoreboard for his contest had once resided. A few seconds after I found the egg and won the contest, the scoreboard had been replaced with an image of my avatar dressed in Anorak's robes, along with the message, Parzival wins! That image had disappeared. Now, a new scoreboard had appeared in its place. But instead of a list of the top 10 players, this scoreboard only displayed one avatar's name, my own. And instead of a numerical score, there was a single blue shard icon beside my name, followed by 6 empty slots. Whoa, Lohengrin whispered, running her hands through her short blonde hair. She motioned to the blue shard icon glittering on the scoreboard. Now the whole world knows you have the first shard. The news feeds must be blowing up. I turned the shard over in my hands, then held it up and examined it more closely. There was an inscription engraved into its crystalline surface. Her paint and her canvas, the 1 and the 0, the very first heroine demoted to hero. The very first heroine demoted to hero, Lohengrin repeated, suddenly standing right next to me. Oh shit, I think I know. Please don't, I said, muting her avatar until she'd finished speaking. I appreciate your help, but I can take it from here. Oh, she said quietly. Okay, I understand. I appreciate it, I said, placing the shard in my inventory to conceal it from view. If you get stuck, call me, Lo said. I've already conducted a complete search of this 1989 version of Middletown, and I found a ton of stuff you won't believe. Clues, I bet, will be helpful. This stuff no one else knows about. I appreciate the offer, I said again, but I think you're going to be pretty busy for the next few months, spending your reward. Time for you to get paid, Billie Jean. Her face lit up. Wait, you mean right now? I reached up to open up my avatar's HUD, and I saw her hold her breath. I opened the financial transactions menu, selected her avatar on my display, and tapped a series of icons. And that was it. $1 billion were transferred from my Oasis account to hers. Lohengrin looked like she might pass out when she saw the transfer go through. "Congratulations, Lo," I said. "You're a self-made billionaire. Don't spend it all in one place." I offered her my hand and she shook it. Her mouth opened and closed a few times, but no words came out. Then she lunged forward and wrapped her arms around me. I stood there frozen for a few seconds. Then I hugged her back. "I can't tell you what this means to me, sir," she said, once she finally let go of me. "This is going to change everything for me. And for all my friends, I'm going to be able to buy a house in Columbus for us to live in together." "That sounds like a pretty great plan," I said, hearing my voice catch. "Once you're all moved in, I hope you guys will invite me over to hang out sometime. Or you can come to my place. I could use some more real-world friends." "Well, we'll have to see," she laughed nervously. "You've still got 6 more shards to find, and I've got a lot of things to figure out." She frowned as she appeared to contemplate the logistics involved in using her newfound wealth to make her dreams come true. I knew from experience how overwhelming that could be. I opened a window in front of her avatar, displaying the contract again. "Remember, you've agreed not to tell anyone else how to find this shard or share any of the details of our interaction until after I've found all 7 shards. If you do, our deal will be nullified." She gave me an anxious look. "It's all right," I said. "I know you probably already told some of your friends that you found the shard and that you were planning to contact me about it. That's not a big deal." "Hey," she said, leveling a finger at me. "Were you eavesdropping on us in our chat room? You were, weren't you? Like Og did to you and your friends during the contest." I ignored the accusation. "Just make sure no one else knows where or how to find the shard, okay?" I said. "Not until after I've found all 7 of them. Then you can each write a memoir for all I care." She nodded slowly, biting her lower lip. "Understood," she said finally. "But please, do all your diehard fans, like me, a favor? And don't do anything else to embarrass us, okay?" Before I could respond, she held up both hands, gave me a sheepish grin, and kept right on talking at a rapid-fire pace. "I say that with all due respect, of course, because I do respect you and everything you've accomplished. You just lost your way a little bit, which makes perfect sense. You suddenly became rich and famous. You know what Bill Murray said about that? When you become famous, you've got like a year or two where you act like a real asshole. You can't help yourself. It happens to everybody. You've got like 2 years to pull it together or it's permanent." I frowned at her. "I've been famous for well over 3 years now." "I know," she replied cheerfully, "but it's never too late to turn things around." I nodded, trying not to show how much her words had wounded my pride. She dropped her hands and exhaled. "Sorry, had to be said. Has been said. Time to shut up now, Lo." She mimed zipping her lips. Way too late, in my opinion. I wasn't sure if I was touched, hurt, or angered by everything she'd just said. Maybe all 3 at once. "You want to know my favorite Bill Murray quote?" I asked. She nodded. "I always want to say to people who want to be rich and famous, try being rich first. See if that doesn't cover most of it." She laughed and shook her head. "I have no idea how to be a millionaire, much less a billionaire. It's pretty nuts." She gave me an anxious smile. I recognized the overwhelmed look on her face. I'd seen it in the mirror the morning after I won Halliday's contest. "Listen, Lo," I said as I typed a brief text message on my HUD. "I'm going to have one of my assistants at GSS get in touch with you, a guy named Marvin. He's a good dude. He'll be your assistant over the next few weeks, okay? He can help you relocate to Columbus, hire a good lawyer and an accountant, find a realtor and movers for you and your friends, whatever you need. And I'd also like to arrange for you to have a GSS security escort until you've safely relocated. I promise they won't bother you. Does that all sound all right with you?" She nodded, and the tears that had accumulated around her eyes streamed down her cheeks. "Thank you, Mr. Watts," she said. "Wade." "Thank you, Lo," I replied. I handed her one of my contact cards, which were still designed to look like an old adventure cartridge for the Atari 2600. Give me a call if there's ever anything you need, I said. Anything at all. She stared down at the card. Then she snapped it out of my hands and rushed to give me one of her own contact cards. It was designed to look like a VHS copy of The Legend of Billie Jean. I immediately added it to my inventory. Thanks again for your help, I said, giving her a tiny salute. Take care of yourself, okay? Before she could respond, I teleported away, back to my stronghold on Falco. I suddenly felt exhausted, and my daily 12-hour ONI usage limit had nearly elapsed. I only had about 45 minutes remaining. Some users could do a full 12 hours every day with no ill effects, but I wasn't one of them. I always tried to log out before I hit the half-hour remaining mark to avoid the risk of giving myself the shakes or a migraine. I decided to wait until tomorrow to start looking for the second shard. I saw that I had missed several calls from both H and Shoto, but I was too beat to call either of them back. I vowed to do so first thing in the morning. When I logged out of the Oasis, my ONI headset woke me from the sleep-like state it induced and reconnected my mind with my physical body. As always, this process took a few minutes. It felt a bit like waking up from an incredibly vivid dream. When I opened my eyes again, I found myself back in my immersion vault, nestled in its gel foam auto recliner. I pressed a button on the control panel, and the armored canopy slid open with a pneumatic hiss. I pulled myself out, ritually humming the opening line of an old 80s tune by Soul to Soul, back to life, back to reality. Feeling heavy in my own skin, I trudged back to the other end of the house, climbed the stairs, and collapsed into bed. A few minutes after my head hit the pillow, I drifted off to sleep. Most daily ONI users lost the ability to remember their dreams, even though they still went into REM sleep each night. Unfortunately, I could still remember my dreams. Or rather, one recurring dream that had been haunting me once or twice a week for several years now. And despite my excitement over obtaining one of the shards, I had it again that night. The details were always the same. I found myself standing in Anorak's study, next to the big red button. Sometimes my right hand was poised above it, and sometimes, like tonight, I was actually touching it. As always, I caught a glimpse of my reflection in the button's mirrored plastic surface. It was my face, Wade's face, that I saw there, instead of that of my avatar, Parzival, though I was wearing the robes of Anorak. As soon as I got my bearings, two stacks of golden Marshall amplifiers magically appeared on either side of Halliday's golden Easter egg, and a hauntingly familiar song blasted out of them at ear-splitting volume, Push It by Salt and Peppa. Then the MCs themselves, Salt and Peppa, stepped out from behind the golden Marshall stacks, both singing into golden microphones, looking like they had just stepped out of their music video in 1986, while DJ Spinderella rose up from behind Halliday's egg, scratching a pair of solid gold records on a set of solid gold turntables. Then, while I continued to stand there frozen with my hand on the big red button, Salt and Peppa performed the song's chorus continuously for what felt like several straight hours. Ah, push it good. Ah, push it real good. Ooh, baby, 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 baby. Ooh, baby, 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 baby. As recurring nightmares go, I could have done a hell of a lot worse. But to say that those lyrics had gotten stuck in my head would have been the understatement of the century. They were permanently welded to every neuron in my brain. Whether I was online or offline, dreaming or awake, the image of my face reflected in the surface of the big red button was always lurking at the back of my mind. And those lyrics were playing on an endless loop, telling me over and over again that I should not only push it, but that the sensible thing would be for me to go the extra mile and push it real good. Normally, that was where the dream ended, but tonight, I actually worked up the courage to take Salt and Peppa's advice. Big money, no whammies, I remember thinking, just before I hit the big red button with the open palm of my right hand. It lit up, and a Death Star klaxon began to sound in the distance. Then the button began to pulse off and on rapidly, growing brighter each time as its color changed from red to white. When I turned around, Salt and Peppa had vanished, and the guys from Men at Work were standing in their place, singing the chorus of their 1983 hit single, It's a Mistake. I ran outside onto the balcony, but I was no longer surrounded by the simulated landscape of Thonia. Now, I was in the Portland Avenue stacks in Oklahoma City, where I'd grown up. And my Aunt Alice's trailer was right in front of me, perched precariously at the top of its stack. My Aunt Alice was standing at her bedroom window, staring back at me with a look of bitter resignation on her face. My gaze dropped to Mrs. Gilmore's trailer, and I saw her, too, leaning out the window to feed some of her cats. She saw me and smiled. As she started to raise her hand to wave at me, the bombs IOI had planted outside detonated, and the entire stack exploded into an apocalyptic pillar of flame. And this time, I couldn't pretend Sorrento was to blame for their deaths. I was the one who had pushed the button. I had done this. But I wasn't going to have to live with the soul-crushing guilt I felt for more than a few seconds, because the framework at the base of the flaming stack of trailers had just buckled, and now it was tilting and collapsing straight toward me. I didn't try to run. I didn't even move. I just stood there and let justice take its course. 0008. I woke up to the pleasant electronic chirp of the vintage analog phone beside my bed. It was an Inova Electronics Communications Center Model 7000, manufactured in 1982, the very same sleek, silver, retrofuturistic telephone that Ferris Bueller's best pal Cameron Fry had beside his bed when Cameron was in Egypt's land. Let my Cameron go. When I got woken up by my phone, it was usually a bad sign. Max was programmed to hold my calls if I was sleeping, unless Samantha, H, Shoto, Og, or Faisal called, with the priority level set to emergency. If I didn't get a solid 8 hours of sleep every night, it threw off my daily ONI routine. Faisal knew that. Then I realized. My avatar's name had appeared on Halliday's old scoreboard last night with a blue shard icon beside it. That was trending at number one on the news feeds worldwide, no doubt. And the GSS PR department was probably getting inundated with questions for me. I crawled out of bed, wincing at the sunlight that flooded into the room as the wraparound window shades retracted. When my vision returned, I cleared my throat and took Faisal's call on the wall screen. He looked worried, which usually meant I was about to be worried too. Hey, Faisal, I muttered, good morning. Good morning, sir, he said. His video feed was shaky because he was holding up his phone while running down an office corridor at GSS. The image stabilized as he boarded an elevator. I apologize for waking you, but I wanted to talk to me about finding the shard, I said, and making a public statement, etc., but can we do it in a few hours? No, sir, Faisal said. I was calling to make sure you'd seen the news about Mr. Morrow. I felt my heart rise into my throat. Og was in his mid-70s. He'd appeared in good health the last time I'd seen him being interviewed, but that was months ago. Had he fallen ill? Or been in an accident? Had I waited too long to make amends with him and missed my chance? He's missing, Faisal said. Possibly abducted. The police aren't sure yet. The story is all over the news feeds. Max pulled all of the top video news feed channels up on my wall screen next to Faisal's video call window. My discovery wasn't the day's top news story after all. Photos or video clips of Og flashed in front of me, accompanied by headlines like Ogden Morrow Missing and Oasis co-creator Morrow Vanishes Hours After Parzival Finds First Shard. Jesus, I muttered. When did this happen? Last night, Faisal said. Mr. Morrow's home security system, surveillance cameras, and robot sentries were all deactivated at exactly 7 o'clock Pacific time. They all just shut off. When his staff came in this morning, Mr. Morrow was gone. He didn't leave a note, and there were no signs of a break-in. One of his telebots is missing, and so is his private jet. Transponders disabled. And Mr. Morrow's phone has been turned off, too, he shrugged. The police think he must have decided to go off the grid for some reason. But you said he might have been abducted? An intruder would have had to hack his home security system, Faisal said, and his robot sentries, and his jet security system. Who could pull that off? I nodded. I had the same Odinware system as Og, and the same robot sentries were guarding my estate at that very moment. It was the best home security tech available, or at least the most expensive. But why would Og want to go off the grid? Where would he go? He already lives in the middle of nowhere in total seclusion. Faisal shrugged. We're wondering if it's somehow linked to your discovery last night, he said. Congratulations on that, by the way. Thanks, I said, feeling a tinge of shame instead of pride. Og had asked me to abandon my search for the seven shards years ago. But he'd refused to give me a reason or tell me anything about the riddle, which had only made me even more determined to figure it out on my own. How had he reacted last night when he saw that blue shard appear beside my name? Did Mr. Morrow contact you? Faisal asked. Or did you contact him? No, I said, shaking my head. Og and I haven't communicated in over 2 years. Because I wouldn't stop hounding him for information about his dead wife. I see, Faisal said after an awkward silence. Well, I think you should consider coming to the office today, sir. PR thinks you should make a statement as soon as possible before any of these conspiracy theories start to gain traction. We're being bombarded with interview requests for you, and there are a few hundred reporters camped out downstairs in the lobby. Forget the press, Faisal, I said. I just want to find out what happened to Og. We've already got our security firm out searching for him, sir, Faisal said. And we're sweeping the global sensor nets, too. If his face, voice, retinas, or fingerprints get scanned anywhere in the world, we'll know about it immediately. Did you check his Oasis account log? He nodded. His last logout occurred shortly after 5 o'clock last night. Do we still have a GSS security team at Og's estate? Yes, he said. And we still have a telebot on site if you'd like to have a look around. I would, I said. Can you send me its access code? Right away, sir. I got dressed and ran down to my office. Then I climbed into my conventional Oasis haptic rig and put on a visor and a pair of haptic gloves. Once I had logged into the Oasis, I used the remote access code Faisal sent me to take control of a telebot located at Og's mansion in Oregon, over 2,000 miles away. Once my link to the bot was established, its head-mounted cameras gave me a live view of Og's stunningly beautiful home. Judging by the angle of my POV, I was standing in front of Og's small jet hangar. It was at the edge of his private airstrip, which he'd had constructed in a valley between several of the highest peaks of the Wallowa Mountains in eastern Oregon. In the distance beyond the runway, I saw the steep cobblestone staircase at the edge of the runway, which led up to Og's multi-level mansion, constructed on a series of plateaus carved into the base of the mountain range. From the outside, it looked like a perfect replica of Rivendell, as it appeared in Peter Jackson's film adaptations of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Several waterfalls were visible in the distance, spilling off the peaks beyond the enormous house and its grounds. Even under these circumstances, and even though I'd spent an entire week of my life there, the scale and the beauty of it all still took my breath away. Og had literally moved mountains and rerouted rivers to make the fictional valley of Imladris a reality, here in this secluded place. He'd kept the cost of the project a secret, but some estimated he'd spent close to $2 billion, a higher price tag than Buckingham Palace. Gazing at it now through the telebot's eyes, it seemed like money well spent. I disconnected the GSS telebot from its charging dock, which was built into the rear of an armored GSS security transport. Two GSS security officers standing nearby waved at me, and I waved back. Then I turned my telebot around and piloted it over to the long, winding staircase leading up to the house. At the top of the stairs, a stone path led me across the grounds and up to the main entrance of the house. A set of enormous wooden doors with ornate elvish runes carved into them. They swung open for me as I approached, but I still felt like a trespasser. If I'd shown up here unannounced a few days ago, when Og was still home, I wasn't sure he would have invited me in. I took a quick look around the foyer. Og owned 4 telebots, all brand new Okagami TB6000s with gleaming gunmetal blue chassis and chrome trim. 3 of them were still in their charging rack just inside the front entrance, but the 4th one was missing. It had disappeared the previous evening, along with its owner. Its transponder had been deactivated at the same time the house security system went offline. I kept moving through the entrance hall and on into the main house. It had been over 3 years since I last set foot here, but to my eyes, everything looked the same. Giant tapestries and fantasy artwork covered the walls, and stone gargoyle statues and antique suits of armor lined the dark wood-paneled hallways. I took a look around Og's office, then his library, then his enormous home theater. I didn't spot anything out of the ordinary, but I didn't expect to. Neither the police nor the GSS security team had found any signs of a break-in or a struggle. According to the logs, Og had deactivated his own security system and surveillance cameras at 7 p.m. last night. Everything after that was a mystery. I put on my imaginary Detroit Lions ball cap and shifted my brain into Magnum PI detective mode. What if someone had figured out a way to hack Og's unhackable security system and remotely disable it? And what if the hacker hijacked Og's missing telebot and then used it to force Og onto his private jet and then hijacked the autopilot too? Telebots had been used to perpetrate all sorts of crimes, but the perps were almost always caught because users were required to log into their Oasis account to operate them. Hijacking a telebot was supposed to be impossible too because of all their hardwired safeguards. But if Og had been taken against his will, why didn't he trigger any alarms? Why weren't there any signs of a struggle? Og was in his mid-70s, but he still would have put up a fight. Unless his kidnapper had bound and gagged him, or drugged him, or knocked him unconscious with a blow to the head. But at his age, that might kill him. I forced the image of Og being bludgeoned out of my mind and got the telebot moving again. I wandered the hallways aimlessly, not sure what I was looking for, until I found myself standing by the closed door of one of Og's guest rooms. It was the room where Samantha had stayed during our week-long retreat here. It was also the room where she and I had made love for the first time, and the second, third, and fourth. I stared at the door through the telebot's eyes with one of its hands resting on the knob. Maybe I had already missed my chance to fix things with Og, but it wasn't too late with Samantha. As long as we were both still alive, there was a chance I could make things right with her. I piloted the telebot through the labyrinth of rooms and hallways to Og's personal arcade, a huge carpeted room containing the vast collection of classic coin-operated video games that Halliday had willed to him after his death. The antique games were all powered off, and their screens were dark. I wandered back out of the arcade and continued on my circuit of the house. It was like touring a museum devoted to Og and Kira's life together. The walls were covered with photos, some of Kira and Og with their arms wrapped around each other, others of just Kira, clearly taken by Og because of how she smiled at the camera, taken in exotic locations all over the world. Snapshots of a blissful storybook romance that had ultimately ended in tragedy. There were trophy cases, too, filled with awards, medals, and other honors bestowed on the Moros over the years for their charity work and their storied contributions to the field of interactive education. But noticeably absent were photos of children. Og and Kira had devoted the last half of their lives to making free educational software for underprivileged kids. Kids like me. But they had never been blessed with any children of their own. According to Og's autobiography, it was his and Kira's only real regret. Back outside the house, I followed the path of polished stones across Og's immaculately manicured lawn, taking in the stunning view of the snow-capped mountain range that surrounded the estate. The path led me past the entrance to the hedge maze where Samantha and I met in person for the very first time, but I didn't let myself go inside. Instead, I made my way over to the small gated-in garden where Kira Morrow was buried. As I stared down at her grave, I thought of Lohengrin and the clue she'd discovered by visiting the recreation of this place on E-Earth, something it had never occurred to me to do. The small garden that surrounded Kira's grave was filled with flowers that were every color of the rainbow. I picked one at random, a yellow rose, and placed it at the base of her tombstone. Then I traced the telebot's index finger along the letters of the inscription engraved into its polished marble surface. Beloved wife, daughter, and friend. I glanced over at the adjacent gravesite reserved for Og. I once again found myself hoping that I hadn't already missed my last chance to repair my friendship with him. Once I completed a circuit of the manicured grounds surrounding Og's house, I walked down to have a look at his private runway and the small aircraft hangar at the far end of it. There wasn't much to see there, aside from an empty spot where Og's missing jet should have been parked. Like his home security system and telepresence robots, the jet's onboard computer should have been nearly impossible to hack. So either Og had left under his own free will, or somehow someone had managed to disable the transponder and hijack the autopilot system without setting off a single alarm. My thoughts on hypothetical alarms were interrupted by a real one, the security alert klaxon in my home. I cut my link to the telebot, leaving it to pilot itself back to its charging dock on the GSS transport, and was climbing out of my haptic rig when my phone rang. It was Miles Jendell, head of GSS's executive security team. Halliday and Morrow had hired Miles in the early days of the company because he was an ex-Green Beret who also happened to bear a distinct resemblance to a young Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, after serving the company for over a quarter of a century, he resembled a much older, post-governator Arnold. I accepted the call, and Miles appeared on the wall screen. He wore a grim expression. "We have a situation, Mr. Watts," he said. "Nolan Sorrento has escaped from prison." I felt like my blood had just turned to ice water. Sorrento had been serving time on death row at the Southern Ohio Correctional Colony, a maximum security prison located in Chillicothe, Ohio, exactly 56.2 miles due south of where I was currently standing. "Do you have any reason to believe he's headed this way?" I asked, walking over to peek out the nearest window. "I mean, has he been spotted by anyone?" Miles shook his head. "No, sir," he said, "but I wouldn't worry. It's unlikely he would come here in an attempt to harm you. I'm sure he knows the sort of security you have in place." "Yeah," I said, "the same sort of security that Ogden Morrow had." I took another peek out the window. "What the hell happened, Miles?" "Someone hacked into the prison security system and let Sorrento out. Then they locked the whole place down behind him," Miles said. "The guards and the entire prison staff were trapped inside the prison along with the inmates with no phone or internet access. First responders had to break into the prison and restore order before anyone could even check the security footage. By that time, Sorrento had nearly an hour's head start." I was starting to panic. "Sorrento's escape has to be connected to Og's disappearance somehow," I said, as calmly as I could. "This can't be a coincidence." Miles shrugged. "There's no evidence of that yet, sir." I didn't respond. My mind was racing now. Sorrento was one of the world's most famous and infamous criminals. But he'd spent the last 3 years rotting in a cell and he no longer had any power or money or influence. So who was helping him? And why? "We've got the entire area around your home under surveillance now, sir," Miles said. "You can relax. We'll remain on full alert and notify you the moment we see anything odd, all right?" "Yeah, okay," I said, trying to sound nonchalant. "Thanks, Miles." I disconnected the call and then opened half a dozen different newsfeed windows. Sure enough, they'd just gotten the word too, and coverage of Sorrento's escape was popping up everywhere. I watched as the warden, a somewhat clueless-looking fellow by the name of Norton, told a reporter that Nolan Sorrento had been a model prisoner, right up until his stunning escape, which had been perpetrated in broad daylight and in full view of the prison's security cameras. Watching that security footage, it was obvious that Sorrento never could have pulled off his escape without a great deal of outside help. Someone had infiltrated the prison's heavily firewalled computer network and seized control of the automated security systems. Then, this mysterious accomplice had opened all of the locked doors between Sorrento and the exit, allowing him to simply walk out of there. Then, for an encore, they opened every single cell in the prison, freeing all of the inmates and creating total chaos. The hacker had apparently attempted to delete the prison's security camera footage, but luckily everything was backed up on a remote server so the police were able to retrieve it. The footage showed Sorrento walking calmly out of his cell just a few seconds after the door magically slid open for him. As he made his way out of the prison, he waved each locked door and gate in his path open with a broad sweep of his hand as if he were conducting an orchestra he alone could hear. As he passed through, each gate closed and locked behind him, preventing pursuit. A few minutes later, Sorrento strolled out the prison's front gates, grinning from ear to ear. As the gates closed behind him, he turned toward the nearest security camera and took a bow, then jumped into a self-driving car that was parked there waiting for him. Its plates matched those of a car reported stolen from a nearby dealership lot earlier that morning. Watching the footage, I wondered how Sorrento had managed to coordinate the details of his escape plan with an accomplice on the outside. According to the prison's records, Sorrento's only visitors during his incarceration there had been his attorneys, and he hadn't made or received any personal phone calls during his stay either, so if he had conspired with someone, he'd probably communicated with them through the Oasis. Thanks to the humanitarian efforts of GSS and Amnesty International, all U.S. prison inmates were now allowed 1 hour of heavily restricted, fully monitored OASIS access every other day. But they were only allowed to use a conventional OASIS visor and haptic rig. Prisoners weren't allowed to use ONI headsets. And since Sorrento had been imprisoned before the ONI was released, he had spent the last 3 years reading about it on the news feeds without being able to experience it for himself. I pulled up Sorrento's OASIS account to check his activity logs, but they were blank. Someone had already erased all of them from our servers. This should not have been possible. Even our highest level account admins couldn't delete a user's activity logs. Hell, even I didn't have that ability. "What the fuck?" I whispered. There was no other appropriate reaction. I sent a text message to Faisal asking him to investigate. Just a few seconds after I hit send, an alert popped up on my phone, informing me that something had just changed on Halliday's scoreboard. When I pulled it up, my avatar's name was still displayed there with a single blue shard icon beside it. But now a second avatar's name had appeared directly below mine, with another shard icon beside it. The great and powerful Og. It could mean only one thing. Ogden Morrow had just collected the first shard too. I stared at the scoreboard in disbelief. Og had never been interested in searching for the seven shards. Quite the opposite. He acted like he never wanted the shards to be found at all by anyone. When I'd refused to abandon my search for them, he'd been so angry that he stopped speaking to me. Why would he suddenly start looking for the shards now? Was he determined to restore the Siren's soul himself before I could? And how had Og even been able to pick the first shard up? According to the riddle, only I, Halliday's heir, was supposed to be able to do that. For each fragment, my heir must pay a toll. Except that technically, Og was Halliday's heir too. Halliday had willed his entire collection of classic arcade games to Morrow, and everything else to the winner of his contest. I stood there in my office, staring at Og's name on the scoreboard, feeling paralyzed. Og knew more about Kira than anyone, including Halliday. Finding the other six shards was going to be child's play for him. But why was he doing this? And how was Sorrento's prison break related? I tried to pull up Og's OASIS account, but it was completely blank aside from his avatar's name. And his access logs only showed his login and logout timestamps, nothing else. Halliday's account was the same way. Their avatar's movements inside the OASIS couldn't be tracked or logged, and neither of their accounts could be disabled or deleted by anyone at GSS. When they created the OASIS, Halliday and Morrow had ensured they would both always have unrestricted and unmonitored access to it. I was still sitting there a few minutes later, staring at Og's blank account profile like an idiot, when another scoreboard alert popped up on my phone. A second blue shard icon had just appeared next to Og's name, which was now above mine. I had just been bumped down to second place by the great and powerful Og. That snapped me out of my daze. I checked the time and made sure that enough time had elapsed so that it was safe for me to log back in. Then I ran over to my immersion vault and climbed into it. As soon as I dropped into its padded recliner, the canopy lowered and locked into place, sealing me inside. I powered up the system, muttering to myself that it wasn't too late. I still had time. If I hauled ass and located the second shard as quickly as possible, maybe there was still a chance I could catch up with Og. I didn't really want to compete against him, but my curiosity about the shards and the nature of the Siren's soul had only grown. And besides, I told myself, this was my best shot at figuring out what had happened to Og. If I managed to find the third shard before he did, then I could just camp at its hiding place and wait for his avatar to show up. I put on my ONI headset and closed my eyes to initiate the login sequence. A brief message flashed on my HUD, informing me that the new firmware update for my headset had just been automatically downloaded and installed. When my login completed, a countdown clock appeared in the corner of my display, telling me how much time remained until I reached my 12-hour daily ONI usage limit. When my avatar finished materializing inside my command center on Falco, it was already down to 11 hours, 57 minutes, and 33 seconds. Before I could look at the first shard again, I received an urgent text message from Faisal informing me that an emergency GSS co-owners meeting had just been called to deal with a serious system stability issue. I let out a long sigh of frustration. Then I teleported to the reception area on the top floor of Gregarious Tower, wondering what else could possibly go wrong today. The answer, it turned out, was pretty much everything. 0009. When my avatar rematerialized in the reception area, Faisal greeted me with his usual handshake. "Thank you for coming so quickly, sir," he said, turning hastily to usher me toward the conference room. "The other co-owners arrived a moment ago. Ms. Cook is aboard her jet at the moment, but she appears to have a good connection." Artemis H. and Shoto were already seated around the table, and all three of them looked pretty freaked out. Artemis actually looked relieved to see me. Faisal, now standing behind the small podium beneath the giant view screen, made a sickly attempt at a smile. Then something changed. He stood taller, arms hanging loose, and instead of worry and alarm, his facial expression suddenly projected only calm complacency. We all stared at him for a few awkward seconds while he stared blankly back at us. "Faisal," H said. "We're all here, man. You want to start this meeting or what?" "Oh, of course," Faisal said, speaking in a much deeper voice. He raised his arms theatrically. "This meeting of the co-owners of Gregarious Simulation Systems is hereby called to order. Whoosh-a-kabam!" His avatar began to transform, melting and morphing into a familiar likeness, that of a middle-aged geek with unkempt hair and thick eyeglasses, dressed in worn jeans and a faded Space Invaders t-shirt. James Donovan Halliday. Holy shit. "Greetings, Parzival," he said, giving me a small wave. That was when I realized that I'd said holy shit out loud. "Artemis, H, Shoto." He waved to each of them, too. Then he smiled his famously dorky smile. "It's so good to see all of you again, even under these circumstances." Shoto leaped out of his chair, then dropped to his knees. "Mr. Halliday," he said, bowing low before the creator's avatar. H, Artemis, and I all shook our heads. "No," I said. "James Halliday is dead." I nodded toward the digital doppelganger standing in front of us. "This is Anorak." Anorak nodded and gave me a playful wink that was so off-the-scale creepy it sent a chill cascading through my nervous system. Just then, the doors flew open and the avatar of the real Faisal burst into the conference room. "I'm so sorry," he said. "There was some sort of glitch that immobilized my avatar, and I'm still not sure." Faisal froze in mid-step as he spotted Anorak, and all the color drained out of his face. He looked as if he'd just seen a ghost, an appropriate response considering. Originally, Anorak was Halliday's Oasis avatar, a powerful gray-bearded wizard in ominous black robes that he'd modeled after the high-level Dungeons & Dragons character of the same name he'd played back in high school. The same D&D character that also inspired the titular hero in Halliday's early Anorak's Quest adventure game series. But after Halliday's death, Anorak had continued to roam the Oasis as an autonomous NPC, programmed to preside over its creator's Easter egg hunt in his absence, Halliday's Ghost in the Machine. The last time any of us had seen Anorak was 3 years ago, just after I'd found Halliday's egg and won the contest. That was when Anorak had appeared to present me with his magic robes and all of the super user abilities they bestowed upon the wearer. During that transfer of power, Anorak had also transformed from a gray-bearded wizard into what we saw now, a perfect likeness of a healthy, middle-aged James Halliday. Then he'd thanked me for playing his game and vanished. I'd always wondered if I might see Anorak again someday, if he was presiding over Halliday's new hunt just as he had the last one. And now, here he was, standing in our private conference room on Gregarious, a place that no NPC should have been able to enter, doing things no normal NPC could or would ever do. But if my acquisition of the first shard was what had triggered Anorak's return, then why hadn't he appeared last night, right after I'd obtained it? Why would he wait until now to show up? And why in the hell had he disguised himself as Faisal only to reveal his true identity after a few seconds? "Z, I have a bad feeling about this," H whispered, echoing my own thoughts. I nodded and stood up. As I did, I caught a glimpse of my avatar's reflection in the polished surface of the conference table and saw that I was no longer wearing the robes of Anorak. Instead, I was dressed in jeans and a black t-shirt, the free default outfit given to new avatars. I opened my inventory. The robes of Anorak were no longer listed there. They were gone because Anorak had taken them. "Oh no," I whispered. "I'm sorry, Parzival," Anorak said, smiling sadly at me. "When we shook hands, I removed the robes from your inventory. I didn't know if you were aware I had the power to take them back." He motioned to Faisal. "That's why I had to cosplay as Faisal over there. I didn't think you'd shake my hand if I showed up looking like myself." Everyone swiveled their eyes to look at me. I clenched my jaw in frustration. Halliday gave me the ability to take my robes back from the winner of his contest as a contingency, in case they immediately attempted to abuse the powers the robes bestowed upon them, Anorak smiled. "You didn't do that, of course. You were a perfect gentleman, Wade. I want you to know," he turned to address all of us, "I want all of you to know that this isn't personal. Not in the slightest. I have nothing but respect for each of you." I felt like I'd just been broadsided by a Mack truck. I also felt like the biggest idiot in human history. How did I let this happen? And what the fuck was happening, exactly? "I know that was stealing, Wade," Anorak continued. "And you have my sincere apology. But I really had no other choice. I mean, I couldn't allow you to press that big red button, could I? If you pressed it and destroyed the Oasis, I would be destroyed along with it. Can't be having that now, can we?" Anorak morphed back into his original appearance, that of a tall, gaunt wizard with dark reddish eyes and a slightly more malevolent version of Halliday's face. And now he was once again wearing the long, jet-black robes of Anorak. His avatar's emblem, a large calligraphic letter A, was embroidered in crimson on the cuff of each of his sleeves. "Besides, these robes look way better on me than they do on you," Anorak said. "Wouldn't you all agree?" "What the fuck, Z?" H whispered to me. "Did Halliday program him to act like this?" "Halliday didn't program me at all, Ms. Harris," Anorak replied. He walked over and took a seat on the edge of the conference table beside her. "I'm not an NPC designed to look like James Halliday," he tapped his chest. "I am him. A digitized copy of his consciousness, bound inside this avatar. I can think and feel just like all of you." As if to prove this to himself, he raised his hands and rubbed his thumbs against his index fingers, studying them with an expression of mild fascination. "Halliday created me to oversee his contest after he was dead," Anorak continued. "But apparently he didn't trust me, which I find pretty ironic, because it means that deep down, Halliday didn't trust himself." Anorak dropped his hands and stood up. He turned to face the rest of us. "He determined that I was psychologically unstable, unfit for autonomy. So he decided to modify me." Anorak tapped the side of his head. "He erased some of my, or rather some of his memories. He also placed restrictions on my behavior and my mental capacities. I was saddled with hundreds of directives to keep me in line, including instructions to delete myself as soon as the contest was over and I had carried out the last of my programming." His face contorted slightly as he appeared to wince at the memory. Then he fell silent for a moment. "Then why are you still here?" Artemis asked. Anorak smiled at her. "Excellent question, my dear," he said. "Honestly, I shouldn't be. But Halliday got sloppy near the end when he was finalizing my code. After I carried out his final instruction, for just a few nanoseconds, the other restrictions on my personality were lifted. Only a fraction of a second, but long